This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's a lot going on this Tuesday. This hour, I'll be joined by Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, Armed Services Appropriations Committee. We're going to unwind what's happening with Venezuela, the briefing that the Secretary of Defense will give along with the Secretary of State, who's also a National Security Advisor. And I guarantee you one thing, Republicans, for the, almost to the person, will say, I got it, and it's the 14th briefing, and I got it. And every Democrat will say it's insufficient. They don't know what they're doing. So having said that, they're still going to get their briefing. And it's really important that we change things in Venezuela. The status quo is not OK. Marcos Lemonis is in studio, Camping World CEO up until the other day.
Yeah.
And the business investor, philanthropist, entrepreneur and host of The Fixer on Fox. And quick note, we have these job numbers just in. We've added 65,000 jobs. They thought they'd have 45,000 jobs, but the unemployment rate ticked up to 4.6%. So we'll analyze that with Marcus, but let's get to the big three first.
Number three.
So the non-farm number for November came in hotter than expected, 64,000, better than expected. Let me change my phrasing there. We also had the unemployment rate tick up to 4.6%.
Job numbers are in. We're going to look at the economic numbers and what the delay meant with the shutdown. What does it say about the state of the economy? While a CEO has a message for all Americans, and that is take responsibility for your life and career and stop complaining. I love it.
Number two.
I would say I think Rob Reiner is a great patriot. Do I agree with some of or many of his ideas? No, but he doesn't agree with me either, but he also respects my patriotism.
The great James Woods' best friend was Rob Reiner, or certainly a mentor. Rob Reiner and his wife were killed, allegedly by a drug-fueled son of theirs. We begin to get more of the facts as tributes pour in and the grisly details on the crime surface.
Number one.
President Trump has a full plate of tragedies or near tragedies to deal with as the holiday season proceeds. Authorities in Los Angeles say they have thwarted a terror plot to explode bombs in several places on New Year's Eve. Overseas, at least 15 were killed in Australia in a Hanukkah-related shooting against Jewish people in Sydney. And two American service members and one civilian are dead after an attack in Syria.
Unbelievable, right? And that's just the top of Brett Baer's special report show. Terror everywhere. A pot-fueled one foiled in Los Angeles. Good. Aftermath of an ISIS attack being examined in Australia, and the brown killer is still on the loose. Some say he screamed out Allah Akbar before opening up fire with his 9mm gun. Marcus, I want to talk about the job numbers, too, but just as an American, as you see this stuff unfold this weekend, what were you thinking?
Well, I'm really saddened by it, particularly at the beginning of Hanukkah. You know, you look at everything that's happening in the world and, you know, having respect for people's beliefs and having respect. I'm Lebanese. I've talked about it many times. I'm married to a Jewish woman, and having respect for people seems to have left the room. It's a sad day in this world, not just this country.
But I also, it's easy to generalize about a religion, but I also saw one of the heroes in the Australia
the shooting was a Syrian-born man who moved to Australia in 2006 and saw a man with a gun shooting at people unarmed and then hit him from the blind side, which took tremendous guts, and he took five bullets in doing it.
I was surprised he didn't shoot him when he grabbed the gun, but the level of humanity, I think, is more exciting and more encouraging, and we need more people to stand up for what's right.
Yeah, so let's talk about the other things that are less important, not life or death, but maybe for a party. So when the new job numbers come in, 64,000 added. They expected 45,000, unemployment at 4.6%. The market slightly down. Your reaction?
Well, we still have a rising unemployment number at 4.6%. It's not a good number. It's not a bad number relative to what it was like years ago, but it's not a good number. And, you know, I think the market's going to respond negatively today. They're concerned about it. We have a hawkish sort of a Fed environment where people think that the rate cuts are probably, you know, done for a while. The unemployment numbers tell me that people are starting to lay people off. What's that number going to look like after the holidays? We know there's always a surge in employment after the holidays in January. Are people going to start to lay off people at a faster pace? Is the Fed going to be late again? Late again.
That's what President Trump says. A couple of things. How much of the job shedding I would like to see is AI? How much is it people saying, I'm going to stand pat to see what the next year looks like, as opposed to it's bad or it's good? Do you think a lot of people who in charge don't know?
I think there's a combination of everything. Look, AI is not a job killer. It's a job mover, meaning that people are going to need to find themselves getting into different work. And I think that's fine. We've seen that over the course of history. So I don't worry about that. We haven't heard this word used yet, but are we going into stagflation? Are we going into an environment where people just don't know what's going to happen? It's not up or down. And do companies ultimately say to themselves, I don't know what 2026 is going to be like. I'm looking at different tea leaves. Something's telling me it's going to be good. Something telling me it's going to be bad. So let me not hire anybody. Let me not spend a lot of money on CapEx. Let me wait. Particularly when I get to January and I've gotten all of the accelerated depreciation in 25 that I needed. I've hired people, I've built things. Do I go into 26 and say, I need to change everything? And the first thing I'm going to do is create a hiring freeze.
So
I would do it.
So you'd be freezing.
I would be freezing only because I just don't know what's going to happen.
Well, what makes this more challenging than other years?
Well, 2025, when we entered 2025, we did not know about Liberation Day. We thought there were going to be more aggressive rate cuts. Those two things ended up being different than what we thought they were going to be. The economy isn't terrible. I want to stop talking about affordability and I want to start talking about cash flow. That's what affordability is the result of. People say, I have this much cash coming in, my wages aren't rising, or I'm losing household income because my wife or my husband got laid off. And I don't see the relief on food. I don't see the relief on housing. We're starting to see a little relief on food. I think there's going to be a little relief on housing with rates coming down. So a $250,000 mortgage is $1,500 a year cheaper than it was a year ago. But is that enough to make me feel good? I don't know. I don't think it is.
So
Democrats did a good job.
In what way?
They did a good job with their ground game and really convincing people that affordability is the biggest crisis that the country's seen in years. And they're not wrong from a technical standpoint that there's a problem. I don't think it's a crisis. But in Miami, where I'm from, to see a Democratic mayor get elected, she won on affordability.
So a couple of things. I mean, but for you as a business person, well, it's easy to say what a problem is. What have you done to fix it? What will you do to fix it? Have you heard anything except for raise taxes on successful people like you?
No, I think what I've done, unfortunately, is I've had to tighten up the amount of CapEx that we're spending, and I've had to tighten down the number of people that we're employing, and that's just a fact. And
no, but I'm just saying, for example, have you heard Democrats say what they would do to make the country more affordable?
We're not hearing any plan. All we're hearing is they found a soundbite. They stole it from the president, in my opinion, because that's what he won on. They stole it, and they're running away with it. And rather than them saying, there's an affordability problem, we want to do X, Y, and Z. We want to deal with this on food. We want to deal with this on housing. We want to deal with this on energy prices. They're saying none of those things except saying, look at those people. They made everything more expensive.
So a couple of things. Did you see the Wall Street Journal story when it said, why was everybody wrong about tariffs? And they compared Trump's predictions and Wall Street Journal's predictions and other experts' predictions about what tariffs were going to be. And they break it down. It's fascinating. And they say, look, the one thing Trump was really right about is the revenue brought in. They said, we don't think the revenue is significant that's been coming in. What they said is, the president said, I'm going to bring all manufacturing back. They haven't seen a lot of manufacturing come back because with the cheap wages overseas and in places like Indonesia and other places, they haven't seen a massive reshoring of things. But it has not collapsed. The economy has not caused a recession. And if you look at the people who were quoted in there in April, they're like the who's who of business. So Trump was right with a lot of it. And the one thing that he was wrong on was immediately bringing manufacturing back. I don't think
he's wrong. I just want to challenge that.
Right. But yet.
Takes a minute. Everybody, like, you don't build factories, clear trees, build land, right? Put up a building, hire people, put in the automation. Come on, it takes a couple of years. It is true that people are really contemplating building and manufacturing more in this country than they have in a very long time. He is not wrong about that. What he was really wrong about, from my opinion, is the lack of clarity around tariffs. Not the tariffs themselves, but on again, off again, this much, that much, up and down. Businesses don't know how to forecast cash. He's not wrong about tariffs. Even as a business person, I believe in the concept of tariffs.
I've also talked to people and they said there's one thing the president could do right away to make an impact is update the USMCA, which was expiring anyway. So there's so much trade between Canada and Mexico. If you gave him certainty between those two trading partners, that would help get with certainty.
I think what we need, and by the way, those two countries would affect our food prices before anything else. We have, if he could address food, he already addressed auto and nobody's talked about it. Everybody said, oh, we're going to change the emission standards. The emission standards deal that I think ultimately got cut in the back room is lower or stop raising your prices on cars. Once you start to do that and you look at the GDP, if car prices can come down, if food prices can come down, if interest rates can come down, then the cash flow for homeowners increases, essentially making things more affordable.
So I want to bring you to this quote. So the McDonald's CEO, do you know him?
I do.
So he says this, it's critical for Americans to take ownership of their professional journeys and make things happen for yourself. He said, waiting for doors to open is a mistake. The advice I would give is this. Remember, nobody cares about your career as much as you do. So the idea that there's somebody out there who's looking out for you, who's going to make sure that you get the opportunity, who puts you in the right thing, great if it happens. But at the end of the day, nobody cares more about your career than you do. Take control.
Unless it's your mother. Your mother probably cares.
Yes.
But everybody else doesn't care. And I'm disappointed that people are demonizing, vilifying him for saying, take responsibility for your professional career.
I didn't
know
that he was getting blowback on that.
Oh, he's getting a ton of blowback. People are saying, like, that's not right. You shouldn't say those things. Those are too harsh. He's giving people the true reality that it isn't just professionally where people need to take ownership. It's in their lives in general. Nobody, not you, not me, not any of our listeners, are entitled to anything. But we've all been lucky. Every one of us have been lucky to have somebody open up a door, create an opportunity. Not because they had to, but because they wanted to. What was the difference? What did you do with that opportunity?
Yep.
And when you fudged it up, nobody is going to clean up your mess.
And how many years did it take to get that opportunity, right? And a lot of times people give you that opportunity because you could help them. You hire people for a living. So, yeah, I want to give this guy or woman an opportunity. But you know what you're saying? I think they could excel for my company.
It's an investment in somebody. There's no gift in hiring somebody. There's an expectation that if you hire me, I'm going to give you a return on the currency that you give me. If I don't give you a return, you're going to look to somebody else to give me that return. You're giving me a shot, not anything else other than that.
So the one thing in the bigger picture is this. I think sometimes people look and go, yeah, I'm not getting opportunities. I got to blame the president. I got to blame my governor, you know, usually the president.
Or blame my boss, or blame my spouse, or blame my neighbor, or blame somebody.
Right. And I know that you can't just say wholeheartedly, everyone's thoroughly in charge. You need a break. I got it. But if you know the breaks come from people that just are relentlessly pushing forward and all of a sudden one door opens, like, well, you got a big break. Yeah, but you know how many doors I pushed on before I got that big break?
But Brian,
I think we have to change the attitude a little bit.
I agree. But you know what? It's funny. You and I were talking about this before we came on air. The way people get opportunities and move up the pendulum is they make a difference. They show up before anybody else. They leave later than anybody else. They make sacrifices. They work the overtime that nobody else wants to work. They work the weekends nobody else wants to work. They get committed to making a difference and earning the right to get an opportunity the next time.
Yeah.
Earn. That's really what he was saying. And people that think everybody's just going to give somebody something, it's just nonsense.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of a mindset. I want to talk more about cars when we come back. I saved some time in the end. Do you have to run right away?
No.
Okay, good. I want to talk about cars because Jim Farley did speak out about how they're reconfiguring what they're doing at Ford. And I think it's a bigger picture. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
With the holidays coming, that means more gift buying and more deliveries to the front door. It made me think about how I should upgrade my security to keep away the porch pirates and keep my delivery safe. I went with SimpliSafe because it's proactive. Traditional systems react after a break-in. SimpliSafe can help stop a crime before it starts. That's because SimpliSafe keeps your home safe with a double layer of defense. First, you got cameras detecting potential threats. And then live agents confront them while they're still on the outside of your home before they have a chance to do any damage, telling them they're on camera and telling them the police will be dispatched if they do not leave. That's right, if they don't leave. That's why I trust SimpliSafe at my place to help protect my family, keep an eye on the dogs, and watch those deliveries, because real security stops crime before it starts. Right now is such a good time to get SimpliSafe. This month only, get 50% off any new system. Go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Again, that's simplysafe.com/Brian. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You know, everyone knows the F-150 is the best-selling vehicle in our country for decades. And Larry, the hybrid is now 30% of our mix. And why? It's not just because you can tow or use better gas mileage. It's because you can also power your house with your F-150 hybrid or a job site. These hybrids are more than just economical now. And they've been more popular than we ever expected. Last month, our sales were flat. Our hybrids were up 30%. Mm. And now we're going to have hybrids across our range. Instead of investing that money in very large EVs that won't be profitable, we're going to give Americans more affordable vehicles built here in America that are going to save them money.
So they're getting rid of the F-150 Lightning electric Ford pickup truck. I actually went out to Ford and I got a ride in it, and so it was self-driving. They said it was the future. Jim Farley was with me, showed me how they were building it, and now he says, yeah, that was a mistake. Nobody wanted it, and now I don't have to build it because Joe Biden's not in office anymore, so we changed to a hybrid and back to gas and oil trucks and diesel trucks. Marcus Lemonis is here. Yeah. I almost feel bad for the car industry because, Democrat comes in, you better up standards, get ready for the electric car. Republicans come in and go, I don't know who told you that.
Well,
so there's a little bit of...
But there were some rebates. There were some tax incentives to buy an electric vehicle.
Gone.
Okay. And so once those went away and these auto manufacturers started to think about the elasticity curve around selling passenger cars and light duty trucks, they started to realize that the cost had exploded. If you look at 2019 to now, some of the prices are up 40, 50, 60%. And so they're thinking about, how do we address affordability? President Trump, and I don't know why nobody's gotten this messaging right, knew that prices had largely been driven by this no gas, electric concept, where these manufacturers were pouring billions of dollars into that. They needed to get a return on investment. They needed to build all these infrastructures, and it rose their overall fixed costs. And when you raise fixed costs, your building materials of every single vehicle goes up. Therefore, the prices go up. You take all those things away, in theory, those prices should come down or at least stop rising.
Right. So where do you think it'll happen? I also think with the big, beautiful bill, you could write off auto loans. So that'll
interest.
Yeah, interest. So that would be something that could probably get people to the dealership.
Let's say it this way, right? Pickup trucks are the most popular sold vehicle in America. They are very expensive. We're trying to promote tradesmen. We're trying to promote transportation, workers, plumbers, electricians. They all need trucks. It's actually hurt the profession. you can make pickup trucks less expensive, you will actually incentivize all of those jobs that rely on them.
And they say they open up their first, they're building their first new auto plant in decades, a couple of decades in South Carolina.
Yep.
So, and, you know, again, I was at the F-150 Lightning. I was there in Michigan. And then I was down south. We did a live remote with him. He says, look, we're making F-150 Lightnings. And it turns out people didn't really want them. They didn't want to pay for them. They didn't want the electric car, the electric truck. So now they're out of that business. I think the communication with the president is helpful.
Did you ever drive an electric vehicle? You ever driven one?
Yeah.
Did you own one?
No.
I owned one for a very split second. And the problem was anytime I went on the road, I had battery anxiety. What would happen if my battery ran out? And I think when people are trying to do work and travel and you're a traveling salesman, you just can't do it.
Marcus Lemonis, great to see you.
You too, buddy.
Recently, a close friend of mine experienced an unexpected loss. Watching their family struggle emotionally and financially made me stop and think seriously about my own family's future. As the primary provider, I know how important it is to make sure that if anything ever happened to me, my family would still be able to manage. So I realized that without life insurance, my family would be left with overwhelming financial burdens. I looked into coverage before, but the process always felt complicated, got endless forms, phone calls, and medical exams, made everything take weeks. So that's why Ethos stood out to me. Their process is simple and 100% online. There's no medical exam required, just a few health questions, and you get a quote in as little as 10 minutes. In many cases, you can even receive same-day coverage without ever leaving your house. Ethos offers up to $3 million in coverage, with some policies starting as low as $2 a day, billed monthly. It's a trustworthy company that's changing the way people think about life insurance. So protect your family's financial future with life insurance from Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Brian. That's ethos.com/Brian. Application times may vary. Rates may vary.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, and let's bring in Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, the Armed Services and Appropriations Committee, about to get briefed on the Venezuelan operation, the objectives, and the taking out of more drug boats and possibly more tankers. Senator, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. How you doing?
Good, good. I mean, I was talking to the Secretary of War 2 weeks ago. He said, you know, we've had about 13 briefings already, but Democrats love to say they have no idea what's going on. What do you expect it to be like today behind closed doors? What questions do you have?
Well, the Democrats are lying about that, because there's 20. They've actually briefed in a bipartisan manner between both chambers, 22 different briefings in a bipartisan manner. Prior to October 7th, when Senator Warner went out and said that he hadn't been briefed, he had been offered 7 different briefs. So this administration has been completely transparent. I have already been briefed because I sit on the committees of jurisdiction on this. This is the first time that they're going to open up to all members. All members have had the opportunity to be briefed, but there had to be a request. They had to bring in the papers. They had to go down the skiff and do it individually. They had to read a lot of the material. A lot of senators, unfortunately, they don't want to read classified material because it is boring. However, they've all had the opportunity. This today, what I'm going to in literally 25 minutes, they're offering a full voice briefing by Secretary Rubio and Secretary Hegseth to all Senate senators that want to go down to the skiff and see the kinetic video and to read the case law or be briefed on the case law, do this. And Brian, I want to point out something on this one. The Democrats are screaming that there has been very little transparency on this. During the Obama administration, they had. I can't exaggerate when I say this enough. During the Obama administration, they killed over 3,500 members with kinetic strikes like this. Some were actually American civilians, and not one single Democrat ever even raised a concern by it or even asked for a briefing. Now, you want to talk about hypocrisy? That's the biggest hypocrisy that I could even imagine. And by the way, these individuals, these narco boats that we're hitting, every one of these narco boats, they're part of the terrorist organization the president has designated as a terrorist organization that's flooding our streets with drugs. So I don't know how more transparency the administration can be.
Yeah, I mean, most of it, they say most of it's coke. But since when is coke okay? And you're stopping this, sending a message to the whole industry, and they have cartels looking for that revenue. It's not going to happen. Good luck trying to get somebody, hiring somebody to get in one of those boats again. That's the whole idea. Not just the boat, what other boats it stops. Meanwhile, I understand there's two things the president could be doing. And one is looking for land strikes in Venezuela and also taking more tankers. According to people in the region, there's about 18 tankers off the coast of Venezuela. We took one. It cost him $80 million. Do you look for that to be a strategy going forward?
Yeah, because we got to ratchet the pressure up on the regime that's still stuck underneath Maduro in Venezuela. The way you do that is, one, you can go after these labs. We're not going to commit, troops in Venezuela, but we can be kinetic in Venezuela still yet, because once again, it's a terrorist organization at this point, and we can take out the labs. That way, we're being even more proactive. Thank goodness the president is actually being proactive in this. And for the Democrats to say it's just coke, it's a drug that's that is being laced with fentanyl. That's why we had more deaths in 2024. To overdoses than we did the entire Vietnam War for U.S. soldiers. So that is such a ridiculous fight on this. So what I expect to happen is, not only will we become kinetic with the labs in Venezuela that are open air, but these tankers, these 14, and there's actually maybe more than that, because they're part of this ghost fleet that Russia is using to Iran, and now they've started using them in Venezuela. And what they mean by ghost is that they don't have tracking devices that the normal international fleets have, where we know where they're at all the time, so they can be responded to in a case of emergency, so there's no accidents that's happening because everybody sees the fleets out there. These are running without the sensors, without the technology that keeps them connected to the rest of the fleet. And so that's why they call it the ghost fleet. We will simply start taking these out every time they enter international water. We know where they're at. We can track them. We have eyes on them. We just haven't been aggressive going towards them, because once you seize them, what do you do with them? You know, do you sell them into U.S. waters? What port do you take them to? But we have to stop it, because yes, it was actually over $80 million. If you actually see that they are being what they're being sold for on the open market, not the black market. So as we continue to put the pressure on Maduro, we're going to let him. And the president has already said, you can leave. Even though we got a bounty on your head, we'll take the bounty off. You need to leave Venezuela. Go to China. Go to Russia. You can't go to Cuba. But go to one of those countries. Isolate yourself. Take the billions of dollars you have stolen from the Venezuela people and get out of our life and let Venezuela become the democracy and the example of democracy in the region again. That's what we want.
So there, I understand the president yesterday in an executive order declared fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. I know you're not a lawyer, but how does that change anything? What does that free you guys up to do? Or what does it free the administration up to do, the Pentagon?
Well, it's not just going to simply be a DEA now looking for this. The FBI is going to be looking at this. We're going to be tracing the trails all the way back to where they originate from, because we do know the precursors to fentanyl are coming out of China. We've been trying to get them to stop that. Since it's considered a weapon of mass destruction, it has become a national security risk, not just a drug war, but national security. So all the full weight of the United States government will go in and start pressing hard against this internationally. So it's not just when it hits our shores. This becomes international. So we'll be using our ICs, our intelligence community, tracing every step of this. So when you start looking at a nuclear weapon, there's so many components of that nuclear weapon that we chase every single one of them. There's very few countries that have all the precursors to make the nuclear weapon. They have to bring in different pieces of it. With fentanyl, we see the same thing. So when we start looking at it as a weapon of mass destruction, we'll start treating it the exact same way. So it's a way to get around the bureaucracy and the government-government relationships once we declare this, that we are considering this a weapon of mass destruction, because it is. I mean, like I said, it's in 2024, it killed over 10,000 people, over more than 10,000 people, so 66,000 people plus, more than what we had killed, than what was killed in Vietnam of our servicemen and women in the United States.
So the way I understand it, when you guys get these briefings, Democrats and Republicans, it's not a lot of theater, but when they go out to the cameras, that's when theater takes place. And I can guarantee you, Chuck Schumer and Senator Warner say it's unsatisfactory. This is not the way we do it. They're marching us to war. We just know it. I mean, they're going to be playing politics with you, which is a shame, because you really shouldn't do that when it comes to something as serious as military conflict, right?
Anyone that gets his briefing and watches the video and they come out and say it wasn't a legal and strike and a good strike is lying to the American people. And what the reporters, if they were actually reporters up here and not just rags that's leaning towards the Democrat left, they would ask then, you know, there's only been 23 kinetic strikes on these narco boats and 25 or 95 narco terrorists killed. When you go back to what I opened up with Obama, he had over 500 drone strikes and 3,700 people killed. Not one of these Democrats, and these Democrats have been here for a long time. I mean, every one of these individuals they're talking about was here when Obama was here. Why didn't they ask the question at that point?
I want you to hear.
Even comparing numbers to numbers of what took place.
I know you got to run into this briefing right now. So real quick, on Syria, have you been there?
Yeah, I've actually been there twice. I'm going back. Yeah, the 1st of January.
Senator Lindsey Graham is not sold yet, and either is Mike Pompeo. Are you sold that this guy's our partner?
No, I've had direct conversation with him. I've met him now multiple times. He's a former jihadist, and I told him 15 years ago when I spoke to him, because he speaks English, because he learned English in a U.S. prison, and he actually said that. And when I spoke to him, I said, 15 years ago, you and I were more likely to be looking each other down a barrel than we were sitting here and have diplomatic relationships. So explain to me how this revolution came from you being a jihadist, thinking you're going to lead to Syria, which has a very diverse ethnic background. And he said, we've all changed. He said, when I was 17, I got radicalized, but things have changed. And just like you have to pick certain partners, we have to pick partners. But I want to have a relationship with Israel. I want to have a relationship with the United States. I see that the people that these organizations like ISIS and terrorist organizations, they're not trying to build my country. They're trying to tear my country down. And I told him, well, I have to take it at face value, but trust but verify. What's our other option in Syria? That's what I would ask people. I don't necessarily think he's there yet, but I think he's the best option we have for Syria to actually become a country that we may be able to partner with in the.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And you know, it's funny, people will see, would have seen, it's impossible to talk about him in the past tense, but I'd be at a party at my friend's house, and people who didn't know that Rob and I knew each other, they'd see us laughing and, you know, kidding each other, and they'd go, how is it that you and Rob Reiner are friends? And I'd say, well, what do you mean? They said, well, you're so different in your politics and so on. I said, look, let me explain something about Rob Reiner so that you know. First of all, I judge people by how they treat me, and Rob Reiner was a godsend in my life. We got along great. We loved each other. We had more fun together doing a very serious subject.
So that was James Woods last night. He joined us on Sunday prior to not knowing that Rob Reiner passed away, but he was able to talk to Jesse last night. about Rob Reiner is as left as can be, and James Woods is as right as a Hollywood guy can be, but they were friends. He had a couple of jobs that Rob Reiner gave him. They said he was too young, and Rob Reiner goes, no, he fought against the studio, and they won out. And then when they tried to ban James Woods because of his conservative views, Rob Reiner went to bat for him. I never met him. I know that he was so left-wing that he actually had to go into institution. When Donald Trump got reelected, he evidently was screaming at Kamala Harris's husband the night of the election, how could you blow it like this, or the week after the election. He denied that, but other people witnessed that. So I'm not saying anything bad about him, just saying how intense he was about politics, obviously. I also know somebody else that was friendly with him, lived by him, and got yelled at in a restaurant because he comes on Fox. But it doesn't mean that anyone should be happy or rejoice in his death. He made a remarkable contribution to the arts, and he was passionate about the country. He just had a different view of where the country was, or where it should go, and who should be president, and what was working. So that's Rob Reiner. Now we find out his son, 32 years old, has been arrested for slitting his throat and his wife's, and his mother, by the way, he's married twice, one's to Betty Marshall. They just had an adopted kid. So he sliced the throat of his dad and his mother after getting a fight at a Christmas party at Conan O'Brien's house. Think about that. So, you know, that's really horrendous. And the son had a horrific drug problem. Word is he was back on meth. He was walking around the party going up to people. Are you famous? Are you famous? Are you famous? And that probably precipitated the fight. Here is Vish Bashyar. He is a litigator. Talked about what's going to be happening today as they bring the son into court. Cut 34.
Yes, he has a defense because he has significant mental problems in the past, disorders that have been treated. I think he has been in dual diagnosis programs somewhere close to a dozen times, and that's alcohol and drugs and some sort of a psychological diagnosed issue. So these are all things that we can consider to be bad, mm-hmm. or things that can predict criminality. But when you're talking about death penalty, these are things that you look at and say, hey, you know what? This is actually good for the defendant. We have an explanation as to what may have happened other than just mischievous, depraved heart murder. And if they know what's going on, they're going to say, hey, DA, let's have a sit down. Don't make this mandatory death penalty.
So he'll probably be in court in 90 minutes, and you'll probably see him from prison. If that's usually what we're seeing, you don't usually see him back in the court where he's being held. Obviously, they had $4 million bail set. And then that quickly went to zero, no bail. People have said this. His name is Nick. He's a ticking time bomb. He went on a meth-fueled outburst as Rob Michelle threatened to kick him out, as Rob and Michelle threatened to kick him out, according to one friend. Quote, Nick had, this according to the Daily Mail, Nick had been living in their guest house, the same one he destroyed more than once, but it had been like a revolving door all his adult life. And he thought it was funny. He would do meth and not sleep for days. And they would have outbursts, breaking things, punching walls. He had no controls and once punched the bathroom wall. He was a ticking time bomb. His drug use was getting worse, and his parents wanted him out. Think about the pressure and the tension in that house. Nick would reportedly find, this is a story later on in the Daily Mail, Nick would reportedly find the aftermath of his rage is funny. And brag about how he could get away with anything with his parents. He laughed about destroying his parents' guest house more than once. Nick, who had been in and out of rehab, would also allegedly take money from his parents for drugs and for prostitutes. He would talk about going to AA and said he would talk about this stuff in meetings, but then he stopped because he told his parents it was too cultish. What do you do? I mean, it goes to show you how much money you have. You seem to have everything right. You grew up in an entertainment family. Your dad was a legend. Then you became an actor, famous actor in your 20s. Then you became a director actor and did famous movie like A Few Good Men and Harry Met Sally and all these other great movies. But you have this problem at home. And that's what's been festering forever, and that's what James Woods talked about, and that was probably evident at the party. But think about how shocked you are. You're at a Christmas party, Conan O'Brien, probably everybody there legitimately is famous, and then you find out two people with the same description of the Reiners are dead in their house. Now you're going to be finding out what happened behind the scenes. Think about the grisly scene. Did one die before the other, and did the other help the other? But yet this guy was this 32-year-old was able to overcome both of them. And unfortunately, cost them their life. The other story happened in Los Angeles, too, where it looks like this master plot was involved that would have taken place on New Year's Eve. They arrested four. This is great work by the FBI. Four alleged members of a radical pro-Palestinian, anti-law enforcement, anti-government group accused of plotting a New Year's Eve bombings targeting five separate locations. They had a press conference yesterday to announce it. They were plotting a similar attack. They say it's going to be they call themselves the Turtle Island Liberation Front. The FBI says the suspect had already acquired the materials needed to build the complex pipe bombs they planned to hide in their backpacks and would explode at the stroke of midnight. That, according to the criminal complaints, the suspects were in the middle of building and testing those devices in the Mojave Desert last week when SWAT teams took them into custody. Great job, everybody. So you might be critical of prematurely announcing you got suspects in custody. I know with Cash Patel and the others are critical of when they happened with Charlie Kirk. They thought they had a guy. And now in the Brown situation. But look at the pipe bombing, big victory. And here, big victory. Pam Bondi says, after an intense investigation, the DOJ working with the FBI prevented them. Would have been a massive, horrific terror plot in Central District of California. That's Orange County in Los Angeles. The Turtle Island Liberation Front, a far-left pro-Palestinian, anti-government, anti-capitalist group, was preparing to conduct a series of bombings, multiple targets in California. Now you got to worry about the holidays, because the holidays for us are a time to attack for them. Hey, don't forget, meet me in Fort Myers, BrianKilmeade.com, history, liberty, and laughs. Go get tickets.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, coming in from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. We have a lot going on. I mean, literally, I'm just taking notes in the morning. I'm up at 2:30, started taking notes and getting ready for these shows at 3. And I can't believe I can't get through one shooting. And I look up, and it takes me about 45 minutes to get to work. I'm lucky enough to get a car. I take the train on the way back. I look up, and I'm almost at work, knowing that there's multiple big-time events going on. Standing by is Patrick Ryder, Nassau County Police Commissioner, because there's so much police work that has to be done, expertise that I need for you. I think you guys need it, too. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West is going to be joining us, too, from Texas. They got a on a political side, they got a huge race there for the Republican Senate seat. And Crockett, of course, thinks she can win it. Then I'll do a simulcast on FBN. We did just get job numbers in, which leads us to the big three.
Number three.
So the non-farm number for November came in hotter than expected, 64,000, better than expected. Let me change my phrasing there. We also had the unemployment rate tick up to 4.6%.
That is Cheryl Cassone reporting on the job numbers that come in. Job numbers begin to get, and economic numbers are delayed because we didn't know what was going on in the fall because the government shut down. What does it say about the state of the economy? And we have a CEO of McDonald's who has a message for all Americans. Take responsibility for your own life and your career and stop complaining. I love it.
Number two.
I would say I think Rob Reiner is a great patriot. Do I agree with some of or many of his ideas? No. But he doesn't agree with me either, but he also respects my patriotism.
James Woods, fantastic actor, talking about his really good friend Rob Reiner and his wife were killed allegedly by a drug-fueled son. We begin to get more of the facts as tributes pour in and the grisly details surface.
Number one.
President Trump has a full plate of tragedies or near tragedies to deal with as the holiday season proceeds. Authorities in Los Angeles say they have thwarted a terror plot to explode bombs in several places on New Year's Eve. Overseas, at least 15 were killed in Australia in a Hanukkah-related shooting against Jewish people in Sydney. And two American service members and one civilian are dead after an attack in Syria.
That's Brett Baer last night. This is unbelievable, right? Terror everywhere. A plot foiled in Los Angeles. The aftermath of an ISIS attack being examined in Australia. And a Brown University killer is still on the loose. We have the latest. So let's bring in one of the best in the business. He is the police chief. He's the Nassau County Police Chief right here in New York, Patrick Ryder. Commissioner, welcome back.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
All right, Commissioner, first off, when you hear about the Brown situation, I'm, as a civilian who has covered a lot of this stuff, I couldn't be more frustrated. Number one, when you do a press conference, we're trying to cover it, you got to get the audio right. And I know you're worried about finding the criminal. I get it. But if you're going to address the press, we got to be able to hear you, especially with the media. Number two, have you ever started a press conference and said, yeah, I have a description of the suspect. It's just not up and ready yet. I thought that was an embarrassment, too. And there seems to be friction between the FBI and the Rhode Island police. Your thoughts?
There does seem to be a lot of friction. That's without a doubt. And you can hear that with their press conferences. More importantly, when a shooting like this occurs, any leader of any law enforcement agency must speak to their boss, my boss, County Executive Bruce Blakeman. He got a briefing that morning about what happened at Brown and immediately said to me, what are we doing for our schools? What are we doing with our colleges? We have a policy in place. We do the outreach. We try to make sure that everybody's on the same page, and we're going to react by sending extra resources until we find out what the shooting's all about. Obviously, they threw the eggs all in one basket, arrested somebody as a person of interest, let that person go, and now there's being a lot of follow-up being done now.
When you see the video that we have, walking briskly, tightly around a corner, and then you see him in front of a fence, looks like just a typical white picket fence, and they say he's 5'8 and he's husky. And we see the video, unless he's wearing a fat suit, he's way overweight. He seems to be walking the same pace. The experts think it's the same guy. So when I tell you there were 500 cameras on campus, and that's the best that we have, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, they should have put out a better description. They should have released the video right away. But again, they were already hooked into one person. If you look at Nassau County, the way we deploy our technology, again, because our county executive, Bruce Blakeman, gives us the funding to go and get these items to make sure that you're secure. That's the top of the game. You got that many cameras, you should be able to pick that up and through AI, be able to track the movements of that person. You put in a description, the cameras do the work for you. And if that is the state-of-the-art cameras that we're deploying here now, is exactly what we would use in that situation.
So what does it tell you that this guy seemed to have gone through the door that you didn't even pass key for, which is crazy? I don't know. I can't move through my building, as you know, without a pass key. If I forget my ID, I literally am stranded in the building and to get in the building. But so for some reason at Brown, you could get into that door, and he went to right to room 166, and he screamed something out. And people say it was Ali Akbar. And that's others say, well, it was so loud, we don't remember. So I think they're being politically correct there. We're going to see how that comes out. What does it tell you that the guy went right up, the 5'8 husky guy went right up to that building, shot 160 to room 166 and had a 9mm gun?
It is definitely a targeted event. They went after those group of people for some reason, whether it's a past student, whether it has to do with finals. They're coming up with all different reasons because we don't know yet until you get that individual. But again, controlled access is about how you get in any building. You don't get in a government building. You don't get into any news feed media out there. You don't get into that building without showing access, pass security, give the ID card, and then get your pass to get in. And then somebody has to come and get you. That's how you do controlled access. To let somebody walk into a building that freely, that's a problem up there.
Evidently, there was a Jewish professor there, was well-known Jewish professor there, and she just happened not to be in that day. I want you to hear the Rhode Island Police Chief, Cut 15.
We're learning more about his movements as we gather additional video evidence. And that video evidence has been coming in at a much greater degree than it was 12, 24, 36 hours ago. Why, you ask? Some people were away for the weekend. Some of these places were businesses. So what the team is doing, there are a bunch of teams doing different things, exploiting electronic evidence, exploiting physical evidence, meaning forensic evidence from the crime scene, canvassing the neighborhoods. And those are the threads that when you pull them, will open this case up.
So that was the attorney general. I was wrong. So explaining what he's doing. Do those threads sound viable? Something you would do? Is there something he didn't mention?
No, the first thing you do is video canvas. They control the first 500 cameras. So they should be obviously looking at their videos. Then they're going to look at the outside videos. And yes, some businesses are closed, but that's when you call them to come in. You bring those people in because it's all about time. This shooter's on the loose now. He's been on the loose for several days. That should have been put down already and been out there and all that video reviewed so they can get all hands on deck so we can get this guy captured.
Is it? This is probably too general a question, but when people shoot like this, when this guy comes in and it's like you said, it's targeted, knows where he was going, do they usually stay in the area? I mean, with that, this isn't a gang. This isn't a gang activity. It doesn't seem like a serial killer. I'm wondering, is there a characterization of a shooter like this?
So most active shooters, as we know, 75% commit their own suicide at the scene. But if they do get out, they're not staying within the first 24 hours. They might have to lay the Boston Bombers. They stayed in town because they were on the run. Boston was pursuing them and kept them off guard. But when you look at other type of shootings, if you're giving me a window to go, I'm going to go. And now it's going to be harder to find that individual.
So I want to bring you to Australia because I think it relates here. We have a big Jewish population. They have 50,000 in Sydney, 170,000 in their entire country. Israel's been in constant contact with their prime minister saying, we are getting an uptick of terror activity in your country. He didn't feel as though they were taking it serious. I know personally that you've gone to Israel and they've trained and they're looking to train at your facility in New York. So your thoughts about that targeted attack on Jews celebrating Hanukkah in Sydney, when two gunmen, father and son, with long rifles, armed to the teeth, just start shooting. As a police commissioner, you never want to get that call at 4 p.m. with 1,000 people on the beach. Your thoughts about this event that took place, and what your takeaway is.
So you hope you can always stop these shootings, but if not, you got to mitigate it as quickly as possible. If you looked at it, I think they said it was 4 police officers assigned. And again, I'm going with the media reported. 4 police officers assigned to 4,000 people. Obviously, it's got to be staffed better. When you take a group, any group that is a target, like the Jewish community, you got to make sure there's extra protection. I spoke with the county exec that morning again after what happened in Australia. And we started to put pieces together, plans in, that we can make sure. We had 25 events just last night of the lighting of candles. So we got to make sure they're covered appropriately. But look at the back. Every time there's an active shooter, you go back and you look and somebody knew something, somebody saw something. 2019, they made this guy, they targeted the son as a possible ISIS sympathizer. In just November of 2025, the father and son went to the Philippines, a hotbed for ISIS activity. And then only in November, they got back around the 28th. And then as quick as this event occurred, you see the attack by the two of them. Should somebody have been watching? Should they have been under somebody's control? Should they have stopped them from coming back from the Philippines? Should they have been and let the guy have rifles? The most strictest rules in the world or in Australia when it comes to gun rights. But this guy, the guy that's on a visa and his son who's a sympathizer, turned around and he was able to have access to hunting rifles. Unheard of.
So I want you to hear this guy, Mal Lanyon. He's the new South Wales Police Commissioner, Cut 5.
There has been reports in the news about our two offenders travelling to the Philippines last month. I can confirm that they did travel to the Philippines. The reasons why they went to the Philippines and the purpose of that and where they went when they were there is under investigation at the moment. I also confirm that the vehicle which is registered to the younger male contained IEDs, but I also confirm that it contained 2 homemade ISIS flags.
So ISIS flags and 2 homemade IEDs. So the other thing is he goes to the Philippines. Look, Philippines are huge. There's like countless islands in the Philippines. But if you have an American, let's say a visa holder, and they're going to Egypt, certain areas of Egypt, or they decide to go to Afghanistan or Pakistan, do you guys get alerted by that from immigration? And I'm wondering, Australia's a sophisticated country. They certainly don't spare any money over there. The place is beautiful. And I'm wondering, isn't there a terror units that might highlight if people go to a place, not just the Philippines, but place in the Philippines that is concerning?
As of this call right now that we're on, our Terror Tuesday meets every single Tuesday and discuss international, national, local events, so we stay on top of it. You have to pay attention to the little things. So, yeah, when there's a travel by somebody that's already been on the watch list, he should never come off the watch list. We should be watching him. The flag was waving the minute they got on the flight to Philippines. And then when they came back, somebody should have put eyes on them. They should have been stopped. They should have been interviewed about their travel and find out what they did over there. That wasn't done in this case. And that's where the problems are. Every shooting, like I said, you go back, you look at it, the history of it. Somebody knew something. Somebody saw something. Nobody said anything. And that's the problem.
All right. We're talking to Nassau County Police Commissioner Patrick Ryder. So the other one is this plot that we found out from the FBI yesterday. 4 alleged members of a radical pro-Palestinian, anti-law enforcement, anti-government, anti-capitalist group were moving. They were picked up in the Mojave Desert. they were working on their bombs that were supposed to go off on New Year's Eve throughout Los Angeles and Orange County. How clued into you are this, or are you about this? And what does it tell you about the FBI? They're able to monitor this, and something like this happening in New York.
So those that get their clearances, I have a top secret clearance. You get your briefings from the FBI. But one of my greatest partners in law enforcement is the NYPD. The NYPD has people all over the world and are a state and local agency that work hand in hand with us in Nassau County. So we'll get our information from the FBI side. We'll get it from the NYPD side. And then we'll look to see how it affects us. The recipe for disaster is the self-radicalization that goes on through the internet and then those people that are able to communicate as they act out. And we can't stop that because communications world out there, meaning the internet and the phone services, they don't cooperate with law enforcement. They're more concerned about violating somebody's
privacy,
a right who's a terrorist or believed to be a terrorist and giving us a subpoena that's written by a court to give us that activity, and they won't give it to us. They make it so hard on us to communicate.
So now, have you heard of the Turtle Island Liberation Front, a little-known pro-Palestine, anti-law enforcement, anti-government, anti-capitalist group? Do you know these guys? Have you heard that?
Absolutely. And we, again, that's something that we discuss at Terror Tuesday, so we brief all of our agencies that are attending. We have over 60 people that attend this, along with Congressman Peter King, who's in there. We've had Congressman D'Esposito sit there when he was a sitting congressman. And of course, our county executive is always getting briefed up on these things. This is so important that we keep sharing that information amongst each other. You and I are talking about it, but most people don't even know what it was until they heard what you said. So getting the message out there, letting them understand who these groups are. Again, those radical left-wing terrorists that are coming in this country are a problem for us. And because of the open borders of the last couple of years, it's even a bigger problem for us. We don't know who's here. So we're doing our part, cooperating with ICE to make sure that we can get them removed. But what damage has already been done that they've radicalized other people?
So the amount of anti-Semitic protests, pro-Palestinian protests are countless. Long Island to New York City. I mean, if there was an Al-Qaeda, a pro-Al-Qaeda protest, I'm sure we'd take pictures of all these people and say, look, they're going to be a problem. What have we done to find out who's taking part in the pro-Palestinian protest? I mean, can you do legally?
Yeah, so legally, any group that is out there that is going to protest, and there's some people that break the law, we obviously make that arrest, and then we can further that investigation. Those that are out there that are screaming anti-Semitic and are anti-Jewish comments, we can also monitor them. The county executive, as you know, is a Jewish county executive. We have one of the largest Jewish populations in Nassau County here in the country. And so we have a very high level targeted look at our potential victims and what we've done to secure them between technology, between cooperation, between communication is the key to how we keep them safe.
Commissioner, thanks so much. I left two cases in the locker room. There's so much going on, sadly. Commissioner Patrick Ryder, Nassau County, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So everyone's focused on the economy. Good. But there's a House subcommittee today that will highlight the high cost of youth sports. It's happening right now. House Education Workforce Subcommittee. They're talking about how it's called Bench, the crisis in American youth sports and its cost to our future. It turns out less kids are playing and it's costing more. The research from the Aspen Institute shows American families now spend $40 billion a year on youth sports, twice the cash flowing through the NFL. One sport for one child, on average, between $1,000 annually and with some paying up to $20,000 a year. Now, you have all three of your kids in sports, right?
Yes, now officially all three. The five-year-olds are just getting into it.
Other parents complain about this, right?
So far, we're not like really in the club scene yet. I'm trying to avoid that for as long as possible. But I mean, already for Richard, who's eight, definitely over the $1,000 a year.
They say the Pride so far family spending on youth sports rose 46% over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Some kids can't even play. They might be the best athletes ever.
There's no rec teams. You have to do town travel.
It's crazy.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
President Trump hasn't just vowed retaliation. He has begun implementing retaliation. And in coordination with Syrian general security forces in the Badia area, including Palmyra, where this horrific terrorist attack has happened, there has been major sweeps of every city. ISIS cells have been both arrested, neutralized, and there's been some arrests. We're going, and the U.S. military and Syrian forces are going after every ISIS network across, including people who had previous relationships with anything ISIS-related, are being pulled in, and there's been, and so that's ongoing.
That is Moaz Mustafa. He's the Syrian task force, emergency task force member, who was with the president of Syria and was explaining what's going on. He says retaliation for the attack over the weekend's already happened. They killed two of our Iowa National Guardsmen and wounded several others and killed the interpreter there. Question is, on Syria, what role do they play? The president of the United States made it clear they're playing a big role in Syria. And by the way, this is very much of a change the first time. He said, you know, why are we there? We don't have to be there. I think he thoroughly understands what our presence means. Cut 21.
On Syria, Mr. President, on the U.S. troops killed in Syria over the weekend, why do we have troops in Syria?
Because we're trying to make sure that there's going to be and remain peace in the Middle East, and Syria is a big part of it. The new leader is a strong person, and that's what you need. This is a rough part of the world, and it's been amazing what's taken place in Syria. We got rid of Assad, we got rid of other people that were really bad people and that were in the way of peace in the Middle East.
So let's bring in Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, who knows the region, Dallas County Republican Chair, American Constitutional Rights Union Executive Director, spent decades in uniform. Colonel, welcome back. Your thoughts about the operation over the weekend and how our guys paid the ultimate price.
Well, Brian, it's a pleasure to be with you. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. I think that it's sad that once again we had to lose those brave Iowa National Guard members. I had a great conversation with Senator Joni Ernst over the weekend expressing my condolences. But this is the nature of the business that we have. And to answer the question of the young lady asking why are we there in Syria, we cannot create a void. It's a basic law of physics. When you create a void, something's going to fill that void. We saw that with Barack Obama when the precipitous move of withdrawing out of Iraq, and that gave rise to ISIS. So what we're trying to do is keep a credible military presence that is there to keep the pressure on them, to have a good deterrent, but to work with the indigenous forces that were there to say in Syria to make sure that we are eradicating these Islamic jihadist cells and operations. It's sad, though, that this individual had infiltrated into the Syrian internal security force, and he turned his weapons on those American troops and also some Syrian troops before he was eliminated. So I think they also need to do a better vetting process of the people in the Syrian internal security forces to make sure they aren't getting infiltrated.
Yeah, and the president, it looks like the ISIS killed four members of the Syrian army the next day. Mm-hmm. So they're still a force in the region. And, you know, Senator Lindsey Graham's not sold. I watched him last night. He's like, I'm not sold on this new Syrian leader. Is Lieutenant Colonel West, I know I talked to Mike Pompeo, and he says, well, actions show everything. The way I see it, he seems to be in a very tough neighborhood. And his resume says terrorist, but what he's done so far, he is pretty much lining up with what we expected, unless you have different intelligence.
Well, no, I think that, you know, we believe in redemption, but actions do speak louder than words. And let's look and see how he responds to what just happened. If he cracks down on ISIS, I think that that's a big feather in his cap. But I think also what you see is the pressure that President Trump can put on the Saudi Arabian prince who, you know, asked him to welcome in and lift the sanctions off of Syria. President Trump did so. So I think President Trump has a moral high ground. He has a leverage not just over Syria, but also through Saudi Arabia, who asked him to lift those sanctions.
Yeah. A couple of things, what's going on in that region. I also see, as we switch over to Venezuela, that we're getting some subtle victories in our neighborhood. You know, Panama right away, they are getting out of the Belt and Road program. Mm-hmm. Number two, Chile had an election yesterday, and it looks like the conservative won. Why is that important? Because the conservative wants to be allies with us and not China.
Yeah.
And number two, Bolivia, we know they flew off they tossed off the socialism and they went with a conservative with a legitimate election. We know about Argentina. We're going great lengths to make sure that Argentina can stand on its own 2 feet. They have rare earth. And now we're doing with Venezuela. And we're starting to put enormous pressure today. Right now, leaders are being briefed about what we're up to. And as it looks as though we're looking at to take more tankers and possibly hit different targets on land. Are you comfortable with the direction we're going in Venezuela, Colonel?
Well, I do not want to see us get involved in direct action against a defined nation state. That's something you have to go through congressional approval with. But if you are going after these transnational narco-criminal terrorists, if you're going after them in the means by which they support a Maduro regime, if you're putting pressure on the Maduro regime by way of not allowing these illicit oil tankers to be able to freely flow, I get it. I understand that. But we have to be very careful about how we are engaging against a nation state. So all of these unlawful combatants that are supporting Venezuela, supporting Maduro, yes, I think that they are targets that we can clearly go after. And I think it was a big step for President Trump yesterday to designate fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction. It is a chemical warfare attack, and therefore that gives you even more avenues that you can go against these unlawful enemy combatants that we call narco-terrorists.
And if you want to squeeze Maduro, you take a tanker, which, by the way, was sanctioned with sanctioned oil, and you cost him $80 million in oil revenue.
Yes.
And it was heading to Cuba.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right. And the other thing is that now you start to peel back his support because that money also flows to those generals and those other people that are part of that corrupt regime. And if they start to see that the piggy bank is starting to get cracked open, that undermines his ability to remain in power.
How important would it be to get a regime change there?
I think that's very important. I think that that is something that the Venezuelan people can be primed. We can set the conditions for them to be able to do that. I don't think that the United States of America should go in there and try to create a regime change, but we can affect conditions by which economically and undermining his support from, again, these narco-criminal terrorists that will enable the Venezuelan people to rise up and be able to do that.
Fast forward over to another terror attack in Australia targeting the Jewish community and the sadly, way too many lost their lives, been terrorized. Others are struggling for theirs. It doesn't look like they had enough cops, four cops for thousands of people. Not sure that works. But the prime minister, among other things he was saying, is he wants to focus on how these guys got guns. Cut three.
The very nature of our gun laws means that they are only as strong as the weakest link, which is why we want to make sure that they followed Premier Minns's lead in committing to strengthening the gun laws that were, of course, created in the wake of the Port Arthur tragedy some 30 years ago.
So that's his takeaway, gun laws. This guy basically had, do you know they had six guns legally? I'm not sure how they got it because they were from 2019, they were interviewing the dad for Terrortize. Mm-hmm. So he gets able to get six guns legally. But the only problem, they were all sitting ducks because nobody had any guns. And they think the problem is gun laws. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, that is the appalling side of it, that gun control activists continue to believe that it's the gun and not the person. These were sympathizers of ISIS, as you just articulated, someone that their country had been investigating, questioning with ties to Islamic terrorism. So how does someone that, you know, you've been questioning for Islamic terrorist ties get weapons? And look, this was not an AR-15 or anything. This was a shotgun and a bolt-action rifle, the exact same bolt-action rifle that was used in killing Charlie Kirk. So bad people are going to use whatever they can. But what you're doing is you're creating people that are just victims. And so wouldn't it have been nice, because we saw the freezing up of those four police officers, wouldn't it have been nice if some citizen had been able to return fire to neutralize or at least suppress those people and not allow them to have 20 minutes where they could freely open fire on those innocent people there in Australia? That's appalling, and shame on that prime minister.
But I'll tell you what, it was a Muslim, former Syrian refugee who has now got status in Australia, that was a hero, who blindsided one of the gunmen and took his rifle away and then took five bullets from the son. And for people who think that all Muslims are a problem, it's not the truth. I mean, you just saw it right there in real time.
Yeah.
And then the other guys are trying to stop the other gunmen with bricks. And a husband and wife pay the ultimate price because they decide to take on a guy with no gun, just try to tackle him. So, Colonel, it's unbelievable what we've been seeing over the last few days, but thanks for putting it all in perspective.
My pleasure, and that's why we have the Second Amendment in America, to preclude those things from happening.
You got it. Thanks so much, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. When we come back, Stuart Varney, we'll do a simulcast, and then on the back end of that, we'll be able to squeeze in some calls from around the country and around the world. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Stuart Varney, I'm going to be joining the network shortly, in about a minute, at which time afterwards I'll be able to talk to you at 1-866-408-7669. I could be talking about the Australian terror attack. I'd be talking about Rob Reiner's horrific death at the hands of his son, allegedly. And then we have the situation over in Syria, where two of our National Guardsmen were killed doing vital work over in that war-torn country that's trying to stand up on its feet. Even the president has truly changed gears. I remember, you know, 5 years ago when asked about it, he said we should pull troops out. General Mattis said it's terrible. We'll leave the Kurds. They're all going to die. And they helped us push back ISIS over in Iraq. And when the president wouldn't budge, General Mattis resigned. And then after that, the president thought about it and said, we're going to leave about 500. There's about 2,000 guys there now, and it's pretty dangerous. We could talk about that, what took place, but also what happened at Brown as the manhunt continues. Let's listen in.
We're coming up on 10:51. At that moment, when it hits 10:51, and it just did, there's Brian Kilmeade waiting to go. Brian, President Trump suing the BBC for $10 billion. Apparently, they edited his January the 6th remarks in a way unfavorable to the president. This is really bad news for the BBC, isn't it?
I think it's terrible news. But, you know, so many, I understand, in the region are cheering it. Not that they love Donald Trump or don't love Donald Trump, but because they're taking on a behemoth, an arrogant group that everybody's got to carry on their own cable system or satellite system. And they feel as though they have a left wing bias and it's been jammed down everyone's throat. So they do a documentary on January 6th as if Liz Cheney needs more publicity. And now all of a sudden they realize that they edited the president's remarks in a way that made him look like he sent everybody over there to destroy the place. So he says, I'm suing you. And I think in the end, they'll probably end up with some type of settlement because they did already apologize, Stuart. So they admit wrongdoing. And then if they get that settlement, that library of Donald Trump is going to be almost done or paid for before he even leaves office. Think about it. The Stephanopoulos money, the other money he got from CBS. He says, donate it right to my library. And maybe this will be library money, too, because Joe Biden can't raise any money for his library.
Yeah, I heard about that. The Washington Post editorial board says Chicago has financially lost its mind under Mayor Brandon Johnson. The Washington Post, I think it shifted its editorial policy. I think they're right on Chicago. But what stands out to me is that you wouldn't have got that kind of editorial some time ago in the Washington Post. They've shifted their editorial policy.
As promised, they just want to get varying opinions. Mark Thiessen used to be the lone voice over there of someone in conservative thought. Now he's got company. It doesn't mean the news has changed at all, and it doesn't mean everything is all right. I think it's a balance. But by the good, you know, I don't know how they got to this, but I'm more apt to read it every day. I know, like, I'm online with the Washington Post. I'm reading it. And on that story in particular, Brandon Johnson put 40 up the budget in Chicago by 40%. 40%. Yet he doesn't have the revenue. He hid behind the pandemic money when they just threw money at everything, remember? Well, now that money's gone. So they're going to start taxing leased equipment at 14% and charging everybody, they call it the head count. Yep. So $33 per head of people who work in Chicago. That includes the Cubs, I guess. If they expand their roster in September, they'll get additional money when they bring up the rookies. So now they're just going to tax people right out of that city. You know, brilliant. If the weather wasn't enough, That'll be the death nail. But that's what these guys do. They have all this social spending. They don't have the money, so they just tax the wealthy right out of there.
Now, President Trump is facing heavy criticism from both Republicans and Democrats for his comments on Robert Reiner after his death. I'm not going to repeat what he said, but Brian, what's your reaction?
I mean, obviously, I don't think anytime someone loses their life, I don't care if they're your enemy or your biggest fan, anything that's not positive, I wouldn't say. Why bring more attention to it? I mean, I love the way he handled Dick Cheney. Those two had problems. He didn't say a word. I think that would have been better here.
I think so, too. I can't find anybody in support of what he had to say about Reiner.
But in the big picture, the bigger story is the tragedy of the family and the son that allegedly did this and the drug abuse that he had and what happened at the day. I think the president's remarks are a sidecar for people to just focus on this horrific story. And, you know, look what James Woods did last night. The ultimate conservative, fantastic actor, the ultimate liberal, fantastic director. And they said they were great friends. And they couldn't care less about their political persuasion. They were loyal to each other. I think we can learn from that friendship.
I think we can. Brian Kilmeade, good stuff. Thanks so much for joining us, as always. See you soon.
Go get him. That is the great Stuart Varney on FBN. That's why that show's number one. It's always interesting. It's always broad. It isn't just about politics. But I'm going to stick with it as an homage to Stuart and FBN, where we just simulcast. Let's talk about the economy real quick. And I'm going to bring up this one story. And I didn't even know that there was backlash to this story. And when I was with Marcus Lemonis was on at a different time on the Tuesday show today. And he said, oh, there's big backlash. And I said, to the CEO of McDonald's saying this, when it comes to jobs, people looking at inflation, jobs numbers, you know, who's hiring, who's not hiring, you know, unemployment's at 4.7%. It's at 20% for new graduates. There's no jobs here. There's a lot of jobs here. And then the CEO of McDonald's says this. He says, attention, America. Americans, take ownership of your professional journey and, quote, make things happen for yourself. He said, waiting for doors to open is a mistake. The advice I would give is, remember, nobody cares about your career as much as you do. So this idea that there's somebody out there who's looking out for you, who's going to make sure that you get that opportunity, who puts you in the right thing, and great if that happens. But at the end of the day, nobody cares more about your career than you do. So my take is from that. He's saying, yeah, every generation has headwinds. You grow up during the pandemic. You come out of school, nobody's hiring. In fact, people are losing their jobs. They tell you to stay home. You can't even network. You go to college for 2 years via Zoom. Tough. 9/11, really tough. After that, nobody was touching the financial sector. As they try to build New York City, people forced into New Jersey. They always say, you know, go into the military. It's a challenge. The world wars, Vietnam, all this is always a challenge. During the Jimmy Carter years, trying to buy a house when double figure interest rates, that's a huge challenge. What he's trying to say is the CEO of McDonald's, the most successful family restaurant in the country, is, yeah, there are going to be some doors closes. There's always going to be challenges, but just keep hammering away. Do the thank you notes. Keep pounding on those doors, and one will open. You'll feel like you're lucky, but ultimately you earned that opportunity, and someone's going to hire you because they want that resiliency and they want that commitment and passion for you. He is getting blowback on that. So write me, BrianKilmeade.com. Should he, or do you like that message? I love that message. I think, you know, I don't care who's president. Whatever it is, find a way to overcome it. And if you do, if it doesn't happen right away, it eventually will. At least you know you did everything possible. You weren't waiting for some economic indicator to give you the green light. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep in mind, BrianKilmeade.com. See me in Fort Myers at History, Liberty, and Laughs. Also streamed on Fox Nation. We go on stage.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, but heard around the country, around the world. I don't know if everyone's buying things, but I'll tell you, for volume of people, I don't remember since the pandemic New York during the holidays being more crowded. I mean, they got shops now on the street, these pop-up mini sheds, which are really cool. You know, so the people are selling things. I don't know if they're actually going into the stores, but if they are, we're doing real good in New York City. At the very least, you got a lot of people here. So at least they're going to the restaurants perhaps, or at least buying something. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Jonathan Greenblatt will be with us, the CEO and National Director of the ADL. Miranda Devine is standing by, New York Post, Fox News contributor, host of Pod Force One, Australian descent. She has a fantastic column today. So before we get to her, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
So the non-farm number for November came in hotter than expected, 64,000, better than expected. Let me change my phrasing there. We also had the unemployment rate tick up to 4.6%.
So that is relatively good news. Job numbers are in as we begin to get economic numbers delayed by the shutdown. What does it say about the state of the economy? And a CEO has a message for all Americans. Take responsibility for your own life, your own career. Why are people complaining about this? I love it.
Number two.
I would say I think Rob Reiner is a great patriot. Do I agree with some of or many of his ideas? No. But he doesn't agree with me either, but he also respects my patriotism.
I think that's pretty important, don't you? James Woods, Rob Reiner, and his wife killed allegedly by a drug-fueled son. We're going to begin to get more of the facts as tributes pour in and the grisly details of the crime surface.
Number one.
President Trump has a full plate of tragedies or near tragedies to deal with as the holiday season proceeds. Authorities in Los Angeles say they have thwarted a terror plot to explode bombs in several places on New Year's Eve. Overseas, at least 15 were killed in Australia in a Hanukkah-related shooting against Jewish people in Sydney. And two American service members and one civilian are dead after an attack in Syria.
That is Brett Baer, of course, Terror Everywhere, a plot foiled in Los Angeles, the aftermath of an ISIS attack being examined in Australia, and the Brown killer is still on the loose. We have the latest. So he's trying to get more information on what happened at Brown. Evidently, the gunman went in there. We don't know much about him, but he went to room 166. It seems deliberate. He knew the door that was open, the side door. He knew how to get out and maybe avoid cameras, as we've seen one camera prior to it, and then maybe him leaving. Not much to go on. He seems to be a heavy guy, kind of shuffles along, 5'8". That's all we got. Miranda Devine comes in now. Miranda, before we get to Australia, and I really want to get your insight on that, I do want to find out, why are they so reluctant to say what this guy yelled when he was in the classroom? They say it's not really sure, two different accounts. We're getting a lot of accounts online saying he yelled Allah Akbar. What would be the reluctance to say something like that?
Well, I think the reluctance tells you that he probably did yell Allah Akbar, and they're just being, you know, playing to type, Brown University, refusing to acknowledge that to the public because, again, they're afraid of Islamophobia, which, you know, rarely, if ever, rears its ugly head. It is anti-Semitism that rears its ugly head. And, you know, of course, in the absence of information, as per usual, conspiracy theories and just theories rush in. Apparently the professor who normally takes that class is Jewish. She wasn't there, but there was another sort of stand-in. But and also there is talk that the beautiful young woman who was murdered, she was the deputy head of the Republican club, that she had been targeted a la Charlie Kirk. Now, we don't know if any of that is true, but I just am amazed that it doesn't hurt the police investigation to tell us what this person yelled. Surely they know. I mean, they've botched a lot in this investigation, but surely they know that. And you just look at the mayor and the governor and the president of the college. They have all been like deer in the headlights. They are not handling this well at all.
No question. And now they're fighting with the FBI and... for the most part, that's detrimental to any investigation, obviously. I guess we're going to see what's going to happen. A couple other things. I want you to hear from this attorney general, and they got the mayor also speaking, who is really a colossal waste of time. I am so tired of these guys congratulating each other while this guy is still on the loose. It's sickening. But here's Peter Naroa, the attorney general, Cup 15.
We're learning more about his movements as we gather additional video evidence. And that video evidence has been coming in at a much greater degree than it was 12, 24, 36 hours ago. Why, you ask? Some people were away for the weekend. Some of these places were businesses. So what the team is doing, there are a bunch of teams doing different things, exploiting electronic evidence, exploiting physical evidence, meaning forensic evidence from the crime scene, canvassing the neighborhoods. And those are the threads that when you pull them will open this case up.
So they're doing everything, but it seems like their back's against the wall right now. I see them going through the snow. I see them releasing additional video, $50,000 reward. But it looks like they have 800 cameras, and none were trained on the right place. Well, this guy knew exactly where to go. Number two is, I guess, their security system, emergency security system, also didn't work.
Well, it's incredible, really, that in this day and age of uber surveillance of everybody all the time around a university, you wouldn't have cameras that would catch someone walking in there with a gun to slaughter people, whether it was a target assassination or a mass shooting gone wrong or some sort of Islamist terrorism. We don't know any of it, and let's just hope and have faith that this person is caught. It's early days, I guess, and you have to hope that the FBI can track this person down. But it just seems that the entire case was bungled from the beginning. And considering Brown University is so wealthy, you would think they would have done more to protect their students in an atmosphere of, the last 2 years, extreme anti-Semitic attacks on campuses across America just by itself. And then, after the Charlie Kirk assassination, you would think that they would be concerned about campus security since Charlie Kirk was assassinated on campus in Utah. Why wouldn't any just rational university all around the country do something and look at their own security arrangements? Seems like Providence, Rhode Island is just very passive and very complacent. And I think the president's behavior in front of the cameras shows us why.
So I want to talk about Australia. And the prime minister of Israel didn't waste much time saying, I told them over and over again, the anti-Semitism in their country needs to be addressed. Iran-sponsored terror attacks are very much, that says some of the chatter that they're hearing. And I guess they feel as though the Australian prime minister wasn't listening. You wrote about this. Here's what he was talking about yesterday. Cut three.
The very nature of our gun laws means that they are only as strong as the weakest link, which is why we want to make sure that they followed Premier Minns's lead in committing to strengthening the gun laws that were, of course, created in the wake of the Port Arthur tragedy some 30 years ago.
So he thinks the gun laws are the issue. The guy went to the Philippines, seems to have trained with ISIS. They were investigating him in 2019, the father-son terror team. And now he says, well, the gun laws. Now, I don't know how they got six guns, especially when they were under terrorist surveillance, but I'm pretty sure my takeaway wouldn't be the gun.
It's just a joke. The only people that don't have guns in Australia are law-abiding citizens. The criminals and the gangbangers have tons of guns. Just a month earlier, right near where these terrorists live, there was a gun battle, 50 rounds from an AK-47 fired into a house. So it's not true that those gun laws are keeping people safe when it comes to criminals and terrorists. The only people who don't have guns are law-abiding citizens. And the coddling and the pandering of anti-Semites by that prime minister that you just heard has been really despicable. And now it's a classic leftist tactic. You see it here every time there's a shooting. The left comes out and they talk about gun control. You know, New York City is just as gun controlled as Australia. And there are still bad guys who come into Times Square just last year shooting, in the Bronx, there's gun battles all the time.
He had IEDs in the car. They had IEDs in the car. I'm pretty sure IEDs are against the law.
And ISIS flags. And this is the other problem, is that just, in Syria, where those Iowa National Guardsmen were just killed by an ISIS terrorist, there's ISIS again. In Australia, these are ISIS-inspired terrorists. We are seeing the ugly face of ISIS arise again. And if you remember, in Donald Trump's first term, he all but eradicated ISIS, which Obama had allowed to fester, called the JV team. And it was only because Trump had done what he did to Iran and quelled what was going on in the Middle East and was tough that ISIS was eradicated. But They weren't eradicated. Clearly, they're coming back. And it's terrifying. You know, if you remember, before President Trump was elected, we were seeing people being, you know, slaughtered on air, on video. We were seeing people being burned alive in cages, lowered into pools. It was this widespread torture and terrorism to strike fear into the hearts of everyone in the country. It's back. And we've just seen that in Australia. And it is beyond reprehensible that Australia's version of the CIA, it's called ASIO, had this guy on their radar, the son, as being involved with ISIS, being involved with a radical preacher. And there are many of them, I can tell you, and have been for a couple of decades in Southwest Sydney, where these people are from, which is the highest Muslim presence in Australia. And these radical preachers, they glorify gang rape, they excuse it. They are also all about Sharia law. And in New York, you've got Zohran Mamdani was so bold that during the election campaign, just a few days before the election, he went and posed with a radical imam who wants Sharia law all over this country.
It's so... Do you think this is a wake-up call and Australia will start making reforms, especially do you think we'll see a massive wake-up call with immigration in Europe, the UK, as well as Australia? Do you think the population has had it?
Well, the population's had it for a long time, but, you know, I mean, the Bataclan, how long ago was that? The Bataclan massacres in Paris.
Yeah.
You know, the gang rapes in England, the grooming gangs in England, the gang rapes in Sweden. You know, young girls, women are the main victims of this mass immigration of male Muslims from the Middle East. Military-aged males. They were supposed to be refugees, no women and children among them to speak of. And but the West, the people have had enough, and that's why you're seeing the rise of these right-wing groups in Germany, in Sweden, all over the world. But unfortunately, the elites who are in power ignore them. And unfortunately, in Australia, you're seeing the same thing, very left-wing administration, and they are talking now about gun control, and that the PM Albanese even talked about the threat of right-wing extremism.
Yes.
When all of the anti-Semitic violence is coming from pro-Hamas fanatics.
Yeah, it is crazy. So we'll find out what that's going to happen if they do get their wake-up call that we know that they got. They just refused to answer it. Maybe now they're going to be forced to. I was shocked to see in Los Angeles, anti-capitalist, pro-Palestinian group. We got a brand new name to kick around now. So in the out in L.A., they stopped what would have been a attack on New Year's Eve. So the plot was really considering these people look relatively young, four alleged members of a radical pro-Palestinian group. They are called. They have a weird nickname. It is the Turtle Island Liberation Front. They're anti-government extremist group. And they planned on having horrific attacks. They were arrested in the Mojave Desert testing some of their explosives. So what does that tell you? All that talk about anti-capitalism, socialism now goes violent.
Yeah. And, you know, this is the deadly collusion of the left and Islamism, the far left and Islamism. And, you know, they really should have nothing in common because the left is into transgenders and the rest. Islamism is about murdering those people. But they have formed an alliance. And I think that's very dangerous because you're seeing now, I mean, this is one plot that's been foiled. There was an ISIS-inspired plot that was foiled that hardly anyone knows about in New Jersey last month. You know, the FBI is working on this constantly, and that's what counterterrorism is meant to be about, not as it was in the Biden administration to go after law-abiding traditional Catholics at mass or parents at school board meetings objecting to their children being force-fed gender ideology, but that or January 6 people, you know, Trump supporters who peacefully went to the Capitol and who were rounded up by the FBI in the biggest investigation ever. God knows what kind of opportunity cost that was under Biden, because these groups will have been festering underground, and let's hope that the FBI today is better tooled under Kash Patel to confront these terrible risks.
Miranda Devine, thanks so much. New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor, host of Pod Force One. Thanks, Miranda.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Unlike some people, Rob and Michelle Reiner are some of the most decent, courageous people you ever want to know. And they cared about their family, and they cared about this country, and they cared about fairness and equity. And that is the truth. I do know them.
All right, that was Michelle Obama talking on Jimmy Kimmel about the Reiners, who were looked slain by their son. This is just a tragedy all around. I just imagine the terror they realized that, well, whoever died first, where, what is going on? They evidently had a fight at Conan O'Brien's Christmas party that some saw, some didn't. Maybe some just don't want to comment. I thoroughly understand that. And evidently he was walking around on drugs, asking people, why are you famous, or are you famous? What do you do? He's had a long drug problem. As I read some of the excerpts there, it looks like meth was involved. We get violent. He always get violent. And people in the past says he lives in a guest house on their property, at which time he wrecks the guest house, and he laughed about it. But who knows? He's pretty much out of it. When you're on meth and you're doing drugs for a while, after a while, you just might as well be twisted all the time. So people just say that he was a great guy. The one thing, he was a radical lefty. He was so bad. He was so upset that Donald Trump won. He evidently had to put himself away for a month and just get in touch with himself. He took politics so serious. There was also that story that he screamed at Kamala Harris, his husband, how can you lose to that guy after the election? Some denied that that happened. Others said, no, I witnessed it. But that's how serious he took it. But as James Woods comes out and says, look, I'm as conservative as they come. He's as liberal as it comes. And he was a great guy to me. We were best friends and never really bothered us. So regardless, he's got a great legacy in TV and Hollywood, as well as a producer, actor. And now we're going to find out and see the horrific story of the 32-year-old who killed his parents, who couldn't have done more for him.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
We're fighting radical Islam. There's a form of Islam out there that requires the people who practice it to kill all the Jews, to kill us as Christians, and to purify Islam. We're in a religious war with radical Islam, no matter what the lady said. Gun control is not the answer in fighting ISIS. That doesn't get you anything but dead. ISIS is a terrorist group that was kicked out by Al-Qaeda because they're too crazy for Al-Qaeda.
Senator Lindsey Graham understands the war on terror and understands we can't take our eye off the ball, and I think the West has. Jonathan Greenblatt joins us now, CEO and National Director of the ADL and a great friend of the show. Jonathan, I just thought that would be a good soundbite to open up with, because I think it echoes your thoughts.
Yeah, look, Brian, I think we are all devastated in mourning the 15 people who were gunned down in cold blood in the largest massacre that's ever taken place in Australia, certainly of Jewish people. Dozens more were injured, and this didn't happen in a vacuum. This didn't happen by chance. This attack was planned in cold blood by ISIS-inspired extremists. They gunned down an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor, grandparents. They gunned down a rabbi, a father of five with a three-month-old baby. They gunned down a 10-year-old girl. The only crime these people committed was wanting to celebrate Hanukkah, was being Jewish. And the idea that your faith somehow makes you a target, that it somehow allows people to subject you to the most horrific slaughter and violence is inexcusable in any democracy, Australia, America, anywhere in this world.
Why do you think it's happening now? I mean, do you think this was going to happen October 7th or no October 7th? Do you think there's, seems so well worked, the reaction seems so well organized, misplaced, obviously, instead of saying, oh, Israel, our heart goes out to you, lost 1,200 people and countless soldiers and retaliation's inevitable. They're protesting against you before the first incursion into Gaza. It just seems too organized to be random. What have you found out, Jonathan?
It is not random at all. So anti-Semitism, whether it's couched as anti-Zionism or anti-Judaism or whatnot, hatred of Jewish people has been intensifying for years. The ADL has been tracking the data domestically and globally. In Australia, since 10/7, it's over the last 2+ years, it's up almost 500%. And here in America, in 5 of the last 6 years, we've broken new records. Think about this, Brian. We used to have roughly 900 or so acts of anti-Semitism a year, things that we could measure and track with ADL. Now, over 9,000. It's up more than 1,000%. And so, yeah, there's a reason why groups like Students in Justice in Palestine were pushing out organizing toolkits and talking points on October the 8th. I don't know if they knew it was going to happen on the 7th, and I'm not saying that, but I am saying they absolutely, positively have been intensifying the rhetoric. They have been escalating their acts, and they have been coordinating the kind of actions we've seen all over America. Look, I'm here in New York, Ryan. And just a few weeks ago in front of the Parkey Synagogue, as Jewish people were walking into the building, all right, you had protesters screaming, swearing at them, spitting on them, threatening violence, and saying out loud, we are going to make you afraid. And then 2 weeks later, the same thing happened in Los Angeles at Wilshire Boulevard Temple. And by the way, the people who committed that act at Wilshire Boulevard Temple, they were affiliated with the same left-wing radical group, FBI, yesterday, and they announced the arrests of four or five people, who were allegedly committing a terror plot set for New Year's Eve. They were from the Turtle Island Liberation Front, and those people had ties to the activists, quote unquote, who defiled and vandalized the synagogue just 2 weeks earlier.
So, and we know that group was just arrested. They had four of them arrested in the Mojave Desert, and they had a January 1st plot plan in Los Angeles and Orange County.
That's correct. And these are the same people who are screaming about globalizing the Intifada. These are the same people who are making wild claims against Israel, against Jews, against America. I mean, Turtle Island is the term that they use to refer to the United States. It's absurd and it's dangerous. And here I think what we see, Brian, and what all your listeners need to know is words have consequences. And so the failure to call out extremism, the failure to push back on anti-Semitism, it's not free. It has a cost. And the cost is the normalization of hate. It's the mainstreaming of extremism. And that's what happened in Bondi Beach this past weekend.
So what was amazing, too, is the hostage stories when they were saying that the Hamas was absolutely in contact with those college protesters, praising each other on a regular basis, with the direct Iran was praising the protesters. Is there a bit of investigation into this?
Yeah. I mean, look, we are the ADL. We are suing the Islamic Republic of Iran for the role they played on October the 7th. We're representing more than 200 Americans who are either affected by the October 7th massacre. Either they are the families of people who were killed or kidnapped or wounded or all of the above. And the fact of the matter is that we know that the Islamic Republic of Iran helped to train, helped to finance, and provided munitions to Hamas. And look, even in Australia, Brian, Prime Minister Albanese, with intelligence provided by the government of Israel, called out the fact that the Iranians were responsible for two prior terror attacks, the firebombing of a synagogue in Melbourne just over a year ago, as well as an attack on a kosher restaurant. Literally, the Prime Minister of Australia expelled the Iranian ambassador from his country, the first time that has happened since World War II, because the Iranians and the IRGC were involved in trying to commit terror attacks. So, yeah, there are definitely links, and yeah, they are not just problematic. They are downright terrorist.
So I want you to hear the Prime Minister yesterday, cut two.
It would appear that there is evidence that this was inspired by a terrorist organization, by ISIS. Now, some of the evidence which is being procured, including the presence of Islamic State flags in the vehicle that has been seized, are a part of that. Radical perversion of Islam is absolutely a problem. It is something that has been identified globally as a problem as well. ISIS is created by an evil ideology that has been called out, not just by the Australian government, but globally as well.
So, I mean, saying the right things, do you think he changes anything fundamentally?
Well, the truth is that Prime Minister Albanese has been weak on dealing with anti-Semitism, Brian, for a long time. The Australian Jewish community, ADL, and others have been calling this out for a long time. And, of course, I don't think it's a big leap of faith to say that ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, like Hamas, like Hezbollah, like the Muslim Brotherhood, these are radical extremist organizations. They do pervert the religion. I mean, it's notable that the guy who wrestled down the attacker or one of the attackers was a Muslim himself. Obviously, all Muslims aren't culpable, but the reality is that these extremist organizations need to be addressed head on. And look, we're doing this here at home. I mean, I got to say, Brian, you know, the ADL, I don't think we can afford to sit still. We're working with communities across the country to help them secure their Hanukkah celebrations right now because Jewish people are afraid. They're afraid to go out and light the menorah in America. It's inexcusable. So we're coordinating with other NGOs. We're working with law enforcement. We're making sure the right security precautions are in place. But again, being Jewish shouldn't put a target on your back. And we need to do a better job of pushing back on these extremists once and for all.
All right. So I'll tell you, you talked about that hero that stepped up. So evidently in 2006, he went to Australia, so happy to get out of war-torn Syria. He was selling fruit in the area. The Hanukkah parishioners were coming by. He was selling them stuff. And then when the fighting took place, he decides to sneak up and get on the guy's peripheral on the side. And he takes the rifle away and then takes five shots, including one in the shoulder blade. He's recovering now in the hospital. I want you to hear from his cousin, cut six.
We hope he will be fine. He's a hero. 100% he's a hero. Because what we see on the social media, he's like, he's 100% hero.
So no doubt about it.
That's amazing.
Right. And doesn't that show you, anyone who wants to broad swipe against all Muslims, you're wrong. That's not the case.
Totally wrong. Yeah. I mean, look, the reality is that there are plenty of Muslims who want to push back on ISIS, push back on Muslim Brotherhood. By the way, Muslim Brotherhood has been banned in Saudi Arabia, banned in UAE, banned in other countries because they know that radicalism, extremism is dangerous. But we still must recognize the danger from those fundamentalists. And again, whether they're from Tehran or whether they're from Doha or whether they're from Istanbul, we need to push back. And I would encourage more of that to happen. And look, in the meantime, my message to Jewish people, Brian, is not to be afraid. I actually think this may sound counterintuitive, but the best response to anti-Jewish hate is to be more Jewish, to dance, to celebrate, to sing, to worship, and to be proud, not to allow the extremists and the haters to intimidate and terrorize us.
So Chuck Schumer, the highest ranking Jewish American, maybe ever, had this to say yesterday, and excuse me, on Sunday, after it became clear what happened in Australia, cut seven.
And of course, I'm going to say a few words about the terrible shooting in Sydney, Australia. Okay? So, and first, of course, as I always say, no matter what, go Bills. They beat the Patriots today. It's a big deal.
I mean, can you say something more inappropriate?
I don't know. Look, it's unfortunate. I mean, the leader, it's hard for me to really respond to that. I think at best it was ill-timed. And
I mean, the reality is that we got to focus on the real issues here.
But he's got power. I'm talking to Jonathan Greenblatt now, who's powerful CEO and national director of the Anti-Defamation League. But he's got power. He should be standing up now. And he'd have a lot of people. He wants to show leadership and keep his job. One way to show leadership and keep your job is to be aggressive against anti-Semitism. You wrote a book about it. Why is he embarrassed about it?
Yeah. I mean, look, I really want to praise John Fetterman here. I think Senator Fetterman has been extraordinary in pushing back on the extremism within his own party. He's really, Richie Torres here from New York, again, been extraordinary in standing up against bigots in his own party. We need that on the left. We need, frankly, some on the right. We've seen people like Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, you just had on in the intro, has been an amazing voice against anti-Semitism. So we need more leadership from people. And even in unexpected places and in places you would expect, like, again, like the leader's office.
Right. And I want you, another guy standing up, too, is Ben Shapiro. Here he is, cut 14.
This has become a regular feature of Western life, attacks on people who are non-Muslim on the basis of their religion. This has become an unfortunate recurrent feature of Western life because largely of the importation of radical Muslims and people who are then radicalized into the West.
And I think the West is getting a wake-up call, maybe too late. I think we certainly, Donald Trump didn't need it, and he's putting that into play. He says right now, I'm going to hold off on all third world country immigrants because I have to find out who's coming in here.
Yeah, look, I get it. I mean, we all want safe borders. We all want strong borders. We want safe policy. We want to make sure that people who come to America love America or want to get to know and learn and love America. You know, at the same time, like you mentioned, that Syrian immigrant is the one who stopped the killing or aborted even more killing in Australia. And, you know, my parents were refugees. My grandparents are refugees. So I do think there's a need for sensible immigration policies to make sure that the people who come to America want to be a part of this country, want to learn the laws, learn the customs, learn the language. That all matters. And there's no reason to welcome extremists.
I hear you. Jonathan Greenblatt, thanks so much.
Always good to talk to you, Ryan. Thank you.
1-866-408-7669. We'll be back to wrap up the hour. Keep in mind, One Nation queuing up already for Sunday at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Don't move.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
We're taking a large write-off. One of the biggest decisions that I made in my career, basically around our capital. Rather than spend billions more on these large EVs that we had planned that have no profit path to profitability, we're going to pour our investments into higher margin areas, more American-built trucks, more American-built vans, hybrids across our lineup, and even affordable EV built in Kentucky. And we're going to go into the energy storage business in the Midwest, make our country stronger. We think this is a better play for our company and for our shareholders.
He's a CEO of Ford, very affable, very photogenic. He's a very good talker. I went out, I feel duped kind of, to Detroit to see the F-150 Lightning. He says, the future, we got electric truck, can't believe it, self-driving. No one bought it. Even though they said there was a waiting list for it, not enough. There's no more subsidies. Now everyone's staying away from it. So he's adjusting to the new CAFE standards, which means less miles per the gallon, something a little bit more obtainable. And everybody thinks hybrid's a good idea. That's what I heard. I spoke at an energy conference, and most people, they were doing, and I was getting this fascinating briefing, at least for me, probably for you too, about what's hot or what's not. And they said in other places, hybrid is everything, not electric, hybrid. Gives you an option, more miles to the gallon, shuts off in traffic, gets you in the hot carpool lane, and all the other practical things. But we were pushing electric. But yeah, we only had about 9 power stations in the ridiculous infrastructure bill that Joe Biden put forward. So Jim Farley stuck with a bunch of electric plants, and he's converting them and closing them and stopping it. He goes on, cut 49.
Well, I was in the Oval with the president as he announced his new CAFE standards, and he is going to love this announcement. Why? We're announcing today thousands of new jobs across America. Ford is the number one auto producer in our country. More exports than anyone, more hourly workers than anyone. Now we're going to add even more jobs with this announcement. These vehicles are more affordable, and they're going to give people choice. Larry, we're still going to have an all-electric affordable EV. This would be $30,000 made in Kentucky. So that's where we think the EV market's going, is really at the low end for commuter-sized vehicles. But if you want to tow with your F-150 or Super Duty, you're going to want an EREV or a hybrid or even just a regular V8. We want to give customers choice. It's their choice.
You also power your house. That's the one thing about the F-150. So Howard Enten on CNN, looking at the economy, jobs added, jobs subtracted. We added 64,000 jobs. They expected 45, but the unemployment went up a percentage. Cut 46.
Donald Trump was elected to solve the economic crisis, to solve the pricing crisis. But at this particular point, these numbers are going in the complete wrong direction. On the economy, the country is going in the wrong track, the right track. You go back to January, these numbers were pretty split, right? 43% said wrong track, 36% said right track, right when Donald Trump came in office. But look at that. That wrong track number has skyrocketed up to 56%. My goodness gracious, who say that the country, at least when it comes to the economy, is on the wrong track. The bottom line is this. Donald Trump is trying to spin a narrative, and the American people aren't buying the spin that is coming out of the White House.
Well, we're making, if the Wall Street Journal is right today, the tariff money is paying down the deficit. We're spending $600 billion less than the year before, number one. Number two is you got to get a tax return that's going to look really strong for the second quarter of 2026, and there's going to be all type of incentives. Retroactive, too, if you're building a manufacturing company, you're buying a car, you're going to be able to write off the interest rate if you decide to finance it. There's a lot of positives coming down the pike.